Hey, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Fun Drive Tuesday. And we're inching ever closer to ending the June Fun Drive, and you can be a part of it. We are so excited to have you. We are so excited you are with us. First of all, I just want to, on behalf of all of us, on behalf of the staff, the pitch crew, the team, everybody, thank you so much for doing what you've done so far. It has been just an absolutely amazing amount of love that you have thrown our way to the tune of $1,092,621. We have a goal. I'll tell you about that in just a second. But the overall goal is $1.25 million. And we're getting there. We're getting there. 91,000. No, am I right on that? No, I'm not right on that. So I'll get you the total of what we have left in the entire fund drive. So we want to, obviously, we want to get to that point, and hopefully today we'll do our best. But you're very much a part of the equation. So please, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. But again, to everyone who's done something, thank you so much. We so appreciate it and love you for it. We have up until 11 o'clock today. We'll be on for a little bit, and then we'll go back to Pledge Central, and then we'll be on for a little bit, and then we'll go back to Pledge Central, and then Maddie and I will go on at 11. But to get to the $1,100,000 point in the drive, which we're about $7,800 away from, we will get $6,000. That's from Anonymous in Rexford. So this is a big challenge. We have the 2 hours that we'll be on with the roundtable and pitching. So everybody do something as we wrap this puppy up. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. $6,000 that can be unlocked thanks to Anonymous in Rexford, New York. We need to get to the $1.1 million point. And I'll give you an actual total, but we're just about $7,800 away from that. So not too bad. We'll bring you up to date as we move through the morning. Speaking of the morning is made by our wonderful panelists, and they are here collected in Studio A, ready to go at the stories of the day. We welcome Anna Markowitz, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead. Good morning, Anna Markowitz. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. It's a beautiful day, and it was fun to see all of the people hard at work on the fun drive on the way in through the studio. And so make their lives easier and donate.
Yes. You know what? You're right. It makes everyone's life easier. It really does. Thank you. Wonderful to have you here. Larissa Phillips is the founder and director of the Volunteer Literacy Project. She's also a columnist for the Free Press and a Greene County resident. And we love having her back. Larissa, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here and doing great. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being here. Mike Spain joins us, former Times Union associate editor, dear friend of this program. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm great, and I echo that the movement throughout this building as the fund drive continues and marches to an end, hopefully today, it's frenetic and it's exciting, and it couldn't be for a better cause.
Frenetic, exciting, tiring,
but important, really, really
absolutely
important.
Absolutely important. Absolutely important, which is what keeps us going. So that's great. And you keep us going as well. 1-800-323-9262. All right, let's go to the news at hand here and get through some stories. We'll talk about the midterm strategies. This comes out of a couple of things. One, we talked a little bit about the president walking out of the interview with Kristen Welker of NBC News and Meet the Press. The issue at hand, of course, there was about false claims in the election and not only January 6th, but his concerns over mail-in ballots in California that are going under now, that are going, they're doing now. And so that brings us to this story in the New York Times, where the president is using the slow count of mail ballots in California to renew his effort to cast doubt on election outcomes that he doesn't like. Meanwhile, there does not appear to be any evidence to the fact, but that does not stop the accusations from flying. For President Trump, any Democratic election victory is suspicious on its face, even apparently in one of the most liberal cities in America. Not possible for Spencer Pratt to have lost the LA runoffs after the big lead he had, Mr. Trump wrote on social media on Monday. Third world nation. On election night last Tuesday, Mr. Pratt, the reality television personality and the Trump-endorsed Republican, led the progressive city councilwoman Nitya Raman for second place to advance to November's mayoral runoff behind the incumbent mayor Karen Bass, who is also a Democrat. But as election officials spent the following week confirming and counting late arriving ballots, which were disproportionately from Democrats, Ms. Raman edged ahead of Mr. Pratt. On Monday evening, the Associated Press said that she had indeed prevailed. Such fleeting Republican leads are common enough to have a name, the Red Mirage. Yet Mr. Trump, as he did in his own 2020 loss, cast the slow count as proof of theft by baselessly framing Ms. Raman's rise as a Democratic scam. Mr. Trump extended his long-running project to erode public faith in elections and gave an unusually clear preview of how he could greet any disappointing results for his party in November when control of Congress is at stake. He has been anything but subtle about his desire to limit the ability of Democrats to vote by mail, implying with no evidence that simply choosing that widely used means of casting a ballot is inherently suspect. Addressing a gathering of Republican lawmakers in March, he said the way to hold their majority was to pass a strict voter identification law, cracking down on mail ballots. It'll guarantee the midterms, he told them, warning that failure would bring, quote, big trouble. Larissa.
Well, none of us are surprised that Trump is doing this. Trump is always going to Trump. But one of the things that I find interesting about Trump is that he tends to seize on things that are issues. You know, he sees the thing that's there, and then he is crass and crude and sort of takes ownership of it in a way that takes it off of our ability to discuss it reasonably. Because there are issues with voter confidence. It is a little bit weird why does California take so long to count their ballots? There are issues with, I'm just going to go ahead and take a stand on mail-in ballots. I know about mail-in ballots are useful, but I think we should push back on mail-in ballots. I think that voting in person is a really, really important and essential moment in being a Democrat. And I think that that should remain the standard. There should always be the option, of course, for mail-in ballots. But to make mail-in ballots the standard, I think it's a mistake. I think it's going in the wrong direction. I'm not the only person who has gotten teary-eyed voting. You know, like there's something really emotional and moving and meaningful. It's a really meaningful moment to go in and vote. So I think that the more that we, give opportunity for that loss of confidence, the more people like Trump are going to seize on it and exploit those moments.
But this is a system that apparently, except for the complaints within the Trump administration and the president himself, does not seem to be inherently broken.
The mail-in system, like California or all over?
Overall.
I don't care. I still think that it's the wrong direction. I don't think that taking all friction out of the voting process is the best route that we can take. I think that there should be a little bit of friction. It's a powerful and meaningful act, and we should keep that gold standard of doing it in person.
I just think that that mail-in ballots are really essential for disabled people, elderly people, people who might live abroad or veterans. There's soda exploding all over.
Don't worry about me. I'm just christening a ship.
So I don't know. I personally think our voter turnout is too low in this country. And so many people already don't vote. And if we're going to require them to show up in person when there isn't any evidence that there is fraud happening with the mail-in ballots, they were saying that like 0.002% of ballots like might be a fraud. I mean, that's the tiniest number. And so you're going to. My concern is that he's going to say, hey, look over here. Look at this thing that you do, I think, intrinsically not trust. It's a big system, takes a long time. What are they doing for those 2 weeks? And he's going to use that. And he's going to use the fact that they're going to probably lose some seats during the midterms. Hopefully, knock on wood, there'll be a blue wave that happens. And he's going to say, this is why we need to pass the SAVE Act. And the SAVE Act goes so much further than just mail-in ballots. It requires a birth certificate or a passport in order to vote. Every time you move, so, you know, in my 20s, I moved 5 times. I don't think that I am unique in that. And every time you'd move, you'd have to go in person to the elections office to with your birth certificate or passport and say, hey, I moved and I'd still like to vote. This disproportionately affects women. If you've married and you've changed your name and it no longer matches your birth certificate, you have to show up with your marriage license. Like, what? It really impacts low-income people who don't want to pay $160 for a passport in order to vote. I think he's going to use this narrative and kind of drum it up over the next few months, really go hard after the midterm losses, and is going to push for the SAVE Act before 2028 to make sure that they don't lose any more control.
My wife was fuming about this. She said, I got to bring my marriage license. She said, I don't even know where my marriage license is. That happened 33 years ago. I have no idea where my marriage license is. And I said, oh, I know where our marriage license is. And she said, shut up.
That's not the point. You better watch it or we might not have a marriage that needs a license.
Mike Spade.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add, and I think you summed it up really well, is that it isn't a trend. It isn't something new that we're doing mail-in ballots. Mail-in ballots is the way it is in many, many states. It's the way people vote. And I can remember having to be out of town so I could help with my granddaughter was arriving in Colorado during COVID, and we were voting. So we had a vote by absentee ballot in New York. And I remember filling it out and feeling that feeling, checking that check. And I remember I took a picture of myself dropping it in at the Board of Elections into the mailbox, into the slot that they had there. And I was very proud of it. And I sent that out to all my family and said, I voted. And that's and you can still have that pride if you vote by mail. It's participating in the election. That's the patriotic thing. And making it easier for people to participate in a very complex society, and where we're turning everything into, we do all our communication by social media and we do everything by bits and bytes. We don't have that in-person situation anymore to make them then come out to vote. Because you want to make it somehow have meaning, it's already, that ship has sailed. People all over the country are going by mail.
And I understand your argument, Larissa. I do. I just think that it's sort of the cart before the horse. We've been talking about so many other possibilities within voting. I mean, we do have early voting now, but to have a day off to vote or to have it on a weekend so more people can participate. But until those things seem to move into normality, then, yeah, a Tuesday is really difficult to sort of make everything figure out and how it's going to work. Millions of people make it work. But it does seem to be one more hurdle.
Yeah, Tuesday is weird. It's just so random. But I agree. I would love a national holiday. I agree that it's great. It's essential for people who are infirm, who are out of this country, who are unavailable on that day. But that's how it's always been. But now it's like in California, everybody gets ballots, mail-in ballots. Like it's becoming
a
norm.
States.
And a lot of states, yeah.
A lot of states.
More and more. And it is new, that aspect of
no,
it.
No, that's not
new.
That new. It's been that way in Oregon for like 20 years.
Okay, but still, 20 years is still relatively new. And where are we going to stop?
The world
has
changed. The whole way we do everything has changed. Do you pay a bill by getting it in the mail and writing a check?
No,
nobody does.
Right, but paying a bill is very different than voting, and I everything is changing. It's changing so quickly, and I think it's even more reason to stop and to give a little resistance, especially about something
resistance
so important
to people voting and participating. That doesn't make sense.
No,
to me.
That's not what I meant at all. Of course,
sounds that way.
I meant resistance to very quick changes, to massive changes to our society.
Well, it's not
we
massive.
Need some
this
resistance.
Has been happening for a long time. People adjust.
No. Wait, I meant we were talking about massive social changes, and I was saying that we need to resist. We should be pushing resistance towards massive social changes in every aspect of our society. That's what I meant, and I do think voting is something that's so important. And it just keeps it's a slippery slope. So it used to be people who had disabilities who couldn't get to the polls, and now it's everyone. And it's you don't have to get it there on election day. And so at what point, is there a point where you would stop it, where you would say, okay, where's the barrier? Where's the end of that?
Again, I'm going to slightly move on here because I just want to give an update on the totals here. But the other thing is, again, the numbers just don't. As far as investigation after investigation and the lack of evidence that this is a flawed system that has been going on for decades, just doesn't seem to be there. And I know this is a cheap shot, but to the point where the last time the president voted, he used a mail-in ballot. Okay. Right. It works for some people. So.
Yeah. And I think that there are checks in the system. Like they check your signature to make sure it matches the signature they have on file. And if they don't match, then they throw out the ballot. And so it's not just, some honor system where there's nobody checking it.
I was at a meeting right after Trump was elected in 2016. I had a group in Greene County. We were trying to a resistance group, in our very red county. We were a little blue group. And we had some young people who came one day and they were like, why do we have to vote at all? Like in person or anywhere? Why can't we vote on our iPhones? And one of the guys who was there said, who was a lawyer who I thought was really, really smart and kind of sort of wise. And he was like, no. Voting in person is the gold standard. And there's too much opportunity for fraud on his opinion on iPhones. I mean, would we go to iPhones next?
No, I don't think so, because even just the signature, it's hard to really do a real signature on one of those little finger pads on an iPhone. And
just plug it in, right?
Yeah, and I think that there's more hacking ability there.
Right. If
we
have doubts about the system now, can you just imagine what it would be like if we could vote online? It would just completely undermine the trust.
I agree with all of you. Yeah. about voting on your phones. I agree with all of you. However, the safest system seems to be, do you ever hear people about, I can go and bet on the Knicks game.
Yeah.
Where's any fraud there? Have you heard about that? it isn't that fascinating, though. That seems to be where our priorities lie.
Build a system that's unbreakable, where you can have trust in it that it's going to happen. When it comes to making money. Yeah.
Right. All right. I have good news. We are, I had good news, but now I lost the number. We have $4,900 to make the $6,000 challenge. We are looking to get to the $1,100,000 point on the drive. We are at $1,095,035, actually $135. So right now it's $4,800. $4,800, 48 people at $100 each, and we will be where we need to be. 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC, and we would love to hear from you right now. We'll go back to Pledge Central at the top of the hour. But right now is a fine time to pick up the phone or go to a device. 1-800-323-9262. We're looking to end the fun drive. We need you. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC or WAMC.org. We love you. We hope you can help. Do whatever you can. Help us get to the $6,000 from Anonymous in Rexford, New York. We do have until 11 o'clock, but we don't want to take that long. We are only, right now, only 47, actually less than that. So I have, excuse me while I do new math. radio people doing math is not a good look, but here we go. We're at $4,700. So let's do it. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. Do I need to take a break? Yes. Okay. I need to take a break. We'll do that. And then we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and our panel discussion. Just a few minutes before we throw it back to Pledge Central. Anna Markowitz, Larissa Phillips, and Mike Spain. We have to make $4,600 to open up and unlock the $6,000 challenge from Anonymous in Rexford, New York. We welcome you to help. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. 1-800-323-9262. Let me ask journalist Mike Spain, why is it news that people booed Donald Trump at the Knicks game last night?
Oh, I saw that. That was reported on. Yeah, I mean, there's so much that you can report, and there's so little time to report it. That New York City, that a crowd in Madison Square Garden does not universally support the president of the United States, the current president of the United States, isn't that big a deal. I think it's just noteworthy. I saw one headline this morning on someone's social media that said, Trump jinxed it for the Knicks, which is ridiculous. I mean, but it's the way that people are.
We all knew it was Jon Stewart who jinxed it for the Knicks.
Right. It's all that. But it's interesting. Just getting back on this, strategy of attacking the voter system and the outcome of it, all that. That's also the strategy Trump uses on the news media. He attacks the news media when he doesn't like what he hears and attacks those delivering it. I mean, you saw the Kristen Welker interview on Sunday where he just attached, you're corrupt, you're awful, and so is CNN, so is ABC, so is CBS. And it's just the litany to underscore or undermine people's trust in things. And if you don't like the results, you just underline people's trust. And that's why this fund drive is so important. People need to have good quality media to report the news. So I just like to get the plug in.
Well done, sir. Well done. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We're going over to Pledge Central, find out how things are going in there. And then we will be back. We welcome you. Pat Mamont, WAMC.org, right after this.
I think he also made everybody's
trip
there.
Well, hold on.
There.
I think we're going to take a we'll come back. We'll take a break and we'll do all of this right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Great job just done in Pledge Central. Congratulations. We made the goal, and that is fantastic. So kudos to Ray and Chris for making that happen. So that unlocks it's $1.1 million. 1.1 $1,286,000. That unlocks the $6,000 from Anonymous in Rexford, New York. So keep it coming. We're looking to end the fund drive. We need you. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. And we have, of course, Maddie and I will be back at 11 o'clock in Pledge Central and working on our next goal. But you can still keep it coming. 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. Anna Markowitz is here, Executive Director at Communities for Local Power. Larissa Phillips joins us, founder and director of the Volunteer Literacy Project and a columnist for the Free Press. We also welcome former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain. Good morning, all. Thank you for holding on while we were making our goal, which is very, very cool. Let me go to the other stories that we want to discuss on this Tuesday morning, and we will talk a little bit about Todd Blanche for Attorney General and what kind of confirmation fight this is going to be. What does that look like? President Trump on Monday nominated his former personal lawyer, Todd Blanche, to serve as Attorney General, elevating a loyal and trusted ally who, as the acting Attorney General, has shown a willingness to execute Mr. Trump's maximalist demands. The announcement, teased by White House officials last week, paves the way for a potentially contentious confirmation fight after intense public scrutiny of Mr. Blanche over his role in an administration push for a $1.8 billion fund to pay those claiming they were victims of government mistreatment. The proposal raised the possibility of funneling taxpayer money to Mr. Trump's most ardent supporters, including rioters who attacked the Capitol on January 6th. The nomination was disclosed in a notice on Monday on the White House's website, saying that Mr. Trump had sent Mr. Blanche's name to the Senate. It remains unclear if Mr. Blanche, who promoted an expansive view of executive power, both as Mr. Trump's defense lawyer and as the Justice Department's second in command, will have sufficient support in the Senate to be confirmed as tensions grow between the White House and congressional Republicans. A confirmation hearing for Mr. Blanche could pose a tricky political test for Republicans as the party prepares for midterm elections this year. That reporting from the New York Times. Anna.
I mean, I really hope that they push back and they don't confirm him. I think that if he is confirmed, that we will see him go after more of Trump's perceived foes, that he'll really kind of try to wield that power to make people afraid of Trump. And I just, it's terrifying. And I don't know if the Republicans will have the backbone to stand up to this confirmation. They, at least for most of Trump's current term, have just been, you know, bending over backwards to give him whatever he wanted. I know that they had taken a stand about this $1.8 billion fund because it's just a terrible optics, and it's months before the midterms. And so they're trying to be calculating and saying, please don't make me say that I support this right before I need to go in front of all of my constituents and get reelected. But I don't know. They're also terrified of Trump. They're terrified of him setting up primary opponents. He has had a track record of dethroning incumbents in for his kind of more right wing candidates. So I hope that we don't move in this direction, but I am worried.
Larissa.
Yeah, it's not good. Doesn't sound good. One of the aspects of this story that I've been interested in is the slush fund, the anti-weaponization fund, $1.8 billion fund that would have paid out Trump, potentially Trump followers and allies. And it sounds terrible. It's not a good idea. Some of the problems were that it's, you know, the standards for getting the compensation were unclear. The attorney general would have had control over the process, and it could have potentially included the January 6th defendants or other Trump allies. But one of the things that I was sort of happy, a little glimmer of hope that I liked about this story was that there were Republicans pushing back. And you're seeing it all very cynically, you know, but and I was choosing to see it not so cynically.
That's great. That's refreshing. Yeah.
Because I just look for those refreshing moments. Like I feel like there are so many options, so many issues where there is potential for bipartisan agreement. There's so many things that actually the left and the right, not only the people, I mean, on the ground, there's so many things that left and right people agree on. And there are also some that the left and right politicians agree on. And when they do agree on it, I think it's great. But I'm not, I know that it seems that I just read in Politico that there are Republicans who are still kind of pushing to bring that back to life. But I'm holding out hope that some Republicans are doing the right thing and going to continue pushing back.
Michael.
Yeah, I'm going to predict that he gets approved. And it's as reluctant as some senators are, Republican senators are, to support it. It may drag out. The truth will be in what happens in the hearings and how hard they question him and how Republicans question him. But in the end, I think, Anna, you said it. I mean, he's Trump can exercise a great deal of influence over these incumbents who want to be reelected and make life very miserable for them. And that's ultimately what will probably prevail, sadly. And it brings up the whole question, too, about whether the attorney general is a cabinet member who carries out the general policy and oversees the Justice Department, your top law enforcement person, et cetera, or whether you, as the attorney general, are the personal attorney for the president to handle his personal issues. And that's always been a yin and yang for attorney generals. I mean, you know, like JFK had Bobby Kennedy as his brother, as his attorney general. You can't say he wasn't there carrying out every detail that JFK wanted. But I have a feeling. Who's he going to nominate that would be any better? That's maybe the rationale the Republicans will say. I mean, at least we know Todd Blanche. He's a very soft-spoken, nice guy. We know what we're getting. The devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. And I think between all of that, they'll rationalize it and he'll somehow make some pledges during his hearings that will give them coverage that, oh, well, he said that and he said this and he'll end up being approved. I bet that's what happens. If I was betting on those betting sites, I'd put some money on that.
Calcirific.
Yeah.
And you think that because we so often have seen this case, and although there's also another, there seems to be some change, there seems to be eroding of support, there seems to be maybe a little more hesitancy to go along for the ride no matter what. Although it also seems that whenever it comes down to an actual vote, that erodes.
Well, although, as you were saying, Larissa, the slush fund, the payment fund for the people who were in January 6th riot and would claim compensation, that did get shut down. I mean, I think that, you know, they were ready to stop that and they did stand firmly. And I think the reaction behind the scenes was pretty loud, you know, and you could hear it even break through. But I don't know. This is sort of a compromise. You don't get the fund set up, but you do get that Trump's family still is exempt from IRS audits, apparently forever. I don't know. And it's pretty, I'm hopeful, as you are, Larissa, that there's some show of strength by Republicans to stand up to the president because it was exhibited by that. But I think in the end, he gets what he wants from them.
Can I ask a question about the IRS part of this? Because for all of the reasons of the slush fund and the concerns about the slush fund, do they not apply here when it comes to what the president wants with the IRS and that quote-unquote agreement? The whole idea that you're suing yourself and that you then come out with this agreement that's going to say, well, the IRS can never come after me again. Does Congress, does anyone have any oversight into that to make sure that doesn't move forward?
Well, I mean, I think the IRS under the law is able to broker deals with people who have had legitimate claims of mistreatment, and they have settled things with individuals without having Congress approve it. It technically then would not need that approval. But the odd thing about this is Blanche is not the IRS commissioner. He's not the Treasury Secretary. He's the acting Attorney General, and he brokered this deal. Usually it goes through the, you know, Treasury. There was another person that sued because, just like Trump did, sued the IRS because their tax returns were revealed, a billionaire. And he ended up settling for a formal apology from the IRS and an acknowledgement that they were wrong. And that was how it settled. I mean, so Trump asking $10 billion and now settling for this immunity from the IRS with this fund possibly still being set up because he keeps talking about how much he loves the idea. It's in the area of unprecedented, and maybe Congress can pass a bill after he's out of office and say, yeah, that didn't matter. We're going to audit him again because they audit him all the time. I mean, the leaks revealed that he hasn't paid any taxes for a number of years, and that's very embarrassing. I don't know why we're not focusing on that. And the guy who leaked it did it intentionally. He's on trial, or he's been convicted. I'm not sure.
I think
the
he
status.
Was convicted.
Convicted, yeah. And he went to prison, I believe.
I believe so.
Yeah. So I don't know how you remedy when something goes wrong, but giving all that money to somebody, $10 billion, seems unreal.
Let's take a break when we come. Let's take a break to try to figure all this out. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll work on our last topic for this morning and move on as we continue a special Fund Drive edition of the Roundtable panel this morning. Keep the calls coming for the Fund Drive, 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-9262. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. A delight to have you with us on this very special day. I found a story last night that I thought was really interesting, and this kind of thing always I'm curious about all of this in our greater society, and so hopefully you'll all indulge me in talking about. It is from the Washington Post, and it's a story about grocery prices. And I know we've all talked about grocery prices and the affordability issue that the president seems to spurn, and the even the creation of that word, of affordability. But there is this idea that's going on. Or this thing that is going on, which is dynamic grocery pricing. And states are passing legislation to ban personalized or surveillance pricing, and consumer advocates encourage in-store shopping and awareness. So while grocery prices remain a big concern for Americans, and not just for families looking to stretch their dollars to cover increasing costs, economists, consumer advocates, and legislators, too, are focusing on them with concerns that companies will take advantage of technological advances and a confusing landscape to charge consumers more. I believe for those of you familiar with the term, it's called greed. Dynamic and personalized pricing have been in the news with legislation aimed at stopping retailers, especially grocery stores, from shifting prices unfairly. And they talk in the article about dynamic pricing, which is a term used to describe the way companies adjust their prices in real time to account for factors such as supply and demand, sell-by dates, and competitors' prices. Anyone who goes to a ticketing site to go to a concert, go to a Broadway show, go to a sporting event knows about dynamic pricing. If it's the hot teams, those tickets that could have been face value, although that seems to be something that's gone by the wayside, but face value could have been $80 can then suddenly go up to $700, $800, $900, and just because there is again because of that supply and demand. Well, this is happening in grocery stores. Prices have traditionally gone up and down, particularly for items such as produce, dairy, meat, and poultry, based on fluctuating prices that grocers pay for them. Any store might raise its prices either across the board or for certain products. If it costs for things like labor or rent go up, or it might lower them for sales or to attract customers. But the term dynamic pricing has also only recently become a hot topic, and the phrase is used in different ways. Some grocers use it to mean offering discounts in real time, such as on food that's nearing its sell-by date. Dynamic pricing, unfortunately, has been deemed a bad activity. It means you're only raising the price, said Doug Baker, the vice president for the industry relations for FMI, the association that represents large grocery stores. When in the grocery industry, 9 times out of 10, dynamic pricing means I have the ability to dynamically change through the day a price to a lower price.
Maybe.
Others make a distinction between that use and changing prices for other reasons, such as high demand or the weather. To some, dynamic pricing is any change made in real time based on an algorithm, which can also be referred to as algorithmic pricing. Personalized pricing, or what some refer to as surveillance pricing, is when a retailer uses information about a particular shopper gleaned from a number of sources and often purchased from data brokers to set a price that is different from what other customers are charged for the same items. I will ask a very simple question. And Mike, we can start with you. How is this not evil?
Well, the latter part is a whole lot more clear-cut evil than prior. I mean, if a supermarket wants to lower its price because it, you know, the supermarket across the street lowered its price, that goes on all the time. And I mean, and I don't know how you object to that. We see gas stations that are kitty-corner to each other, and they're all within a penny of each other. And you go half a mile down the road, and they're 6 cents more. You know, I mean, that kind of competitive pricing is certainly reasonable. But this personalized pricing, it just seems, you know, where if you walk into a popular supermarket in Colony during the day, half the people in there are employees doing online shopping orders for people who've done it online. So they have, theoretically, the company would have all this data on you, and they may know what coupons to send you, and it may be they just know what your favorites are. You always like to buy these products, but they also may know from other sources. I'm not saying this company does it, but I'm saying they could know from other sources that you don't really care what you pay for groceries because, you know, you might be wealthy or you're not paying attention and you're not frugal. You never use a coupon. So I'll just kind of jack up the price that you're paying for the strawberries and not charge that generally. And you won't even know it because it's all done online and they know who you are and it paid for with a credit card. I mean, that is so sinister and so diabolical that it offends us. And yet, what do they say about airplane rides? You know, you sit in a triple seat. The guy on your right paid 3 times what you paid. The guy on your left paid a half of what you paid.
Right. I was going to point that out. And they do this. The New York Times has done this both for Broadway shows, and they've done it for the airline industry as well,
right,
where they'll
tickets,
they'll show the seating chart of a plane and show what each person paid. And it's vastly different. Sometimes it can be anywhere from $89 to $800. And but the same is true, of course, for shows and now for food as well, Marissa.
But aren't shows are a little different because, like, if you know Hamilton is like crazy popular and so all the tickets are $800, everybody's paying that, and airlines are particularly pernicious.
Yeah, but that's I agree with you, except that's not always true. I think it's this dynamic pricing of where it's if they're calling for weather, then that person one day may have paid $800, and if they don't think they can sell the other tickets, then they will put them down to $200. Like, there isn't a face value
but
on
that,
the ticket.
That still
it changes.
Is a little bit different. I mean, that's the case. You know, you go to a store, you buy a sweater, and 2 days later it goes on sale. And, you know, for whatever reason that the store had to decided to put it on sale. The airlines is it's such an unpleasant and horrible experience buying an airline ticket because you are getting ripped off. And so you're doing all this like all these shenanigans to like open the incognito window or go to a different computer.
Kill your cookies.
And, yeah, it's like and it's so unpleasant. And I can you imagine? I mean, I personally love grocery shopping. Like, it's something I really enjoy doing. I like to go to the store and not I don't have anything against people doing online shopping, but I like that, and I can't even imagine how unpleasant that would be to know that they, first of all, that they would know all this information about your buying history based on your card that you've been getting sales on all these time, you know, all these years. They know a lot about, you know, those discount cards,
which is
that's why they're collecting data on you. It always kind of bothers me a little bit, but that would really bother me if then, as I walked by, these digital pricing screens were sort of changing to be like, oh, we know that you got this lot, or we know that you are sick and maybe chicken soup is, you know, a premium for you this week or something like that. I don't know. It's so pernicious.
You've been to the doctor this week.
Yeah. And I just we have to push back on this. And transparency, I think, is the most is like really should be an ethos in like a guiding principle in these things. So like have the digital screens or do the changing pricing. But they need to let us know. They like we need to know things. And I'm just a huge I'm generally like saying we need to push back on all these like massive changes. We need to keep IRL experiences as the gold standard, and we need transparency.
I mean, I can't imagine a world where they're changing based on like who's standing in front of, you know, the bell peppers. Like, I feel like that just feels like they would get found out. That's so like someone's going to see it changing as they like walk next to you. So I don't see that reality happening. I think some of it's kind of already happening with the couponing. Like, they just have like a market rate for strawberries, but you might get a coupon because they know that you buy strawberries every time. And if you are cost conscious enough to be couponing, then you get the benefit of that coupon. And people who don't care enough to coupon don't get it. And so I think that that kind of already is happening. And I don't know if it will get much more dystopian than that, because unlike Hamilton tickets, which there's one theater that shows Hamilton, and if you want to see it, you got to go to that theater. In most places, you have other options for grocery stores. And if you see that you're paying more all the time, you're going to go to a cheaper grocery store. I mean, unless you're in a food desert, and that would be really a travesty. But I think for most people, they have options, and they will utilize that if they try to jack the prices too much.
We shall see. Yeah. We shall see how this all works out. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning, Anna Markowitz, Larissa Phillips, Mike Spain. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. We appreciate it. Nice to have you here.
Great to
be
here.
Thank you for your patience. Well, we do this hybrid of panel and pitching as well.
This could be the last day of that, right?
Yes, yes, Mike. It will be the last day of it, darn it.
Hey.
And you can help out right now, 1-800-323-9262.